We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor of Music and Dean of the Kane College of the Arts at Utah State University, Craig Jessup. Welcome, Craig.
Hi, Steve.
We're talking with Craig from Idaho by phone, and appreciate very much your giving us an hour of your time. And we know, as a dean, you're quite busy running a College of the Arts and being a professor of music. Tell us how you got to this position from starting out as a high school music director in Salt Lake City.
Well, it's a wonderful and totally unplanned for journey, and I'm very grateful to a divine hand that sort of guided the path. I started out as an undergrad at Utah State University. It's where I grew up. It's a beautiful mountain valley in northern Utah, about 90 miles north of Salt Lake City.
And where you met your wife.
Where I met my wife in a choir class at Utah State. That's right. And I'm fourth generation from Cache Valley. My great-grandfather was one of the early pioneers, Mormon convert from England, who came from Stoke Rochford, Lincolnshire, England, and was sent up to northern Utah to help colonize the area. And it's where my grandfather, my father, and where I was born. And it's just a beautiful place. And I had intended on being a university professor. I wanted to emulate my professor, Dr. William Ramsey, who had come to Utah State. So I started my career, did a master's at Brigham Young University, all in choral music education, after my bachelor's at Utah State. Taught high school for 3 years in Salt Lake City, and then wanted to get a doctorate. Went out to Stanford University and did a doctorate of musical arts and conducting, and then I was supposedly ready to jump onto a university position, but a knock came to the door from the United States Air Force, and I became director of the Air Force Singing Sergeants in Washington, D.C., commissioned officer in the Air Force. From there, 8 years there, 4 years in Germany as commander of the Air Force Band of Europe, 4 years in Omaha as director of the Strategic Air Command Band, which later became the Air Combat Command Heartland of America Band.
And by the time you retired, you were a colonel, lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel. Yeah. And I was invited to become the associate director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir in 95. 4 years later, became the 14th conductor of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, which I served in that position for 9 years. So I had 13 years total with the Tabernacle Choir.
And directing over 300 singers.
That's right, 360 singers, and we oversaw the creation of the orchestra at Temple Square, an all-volunteer, professional-caliber orchestra. It became a vital part of our program, a training school, the Temple Square Chorale, the bells on Temple Square, and had a marvelous experience. But it was time to slow down a little, and an opportunity came to go back to where I started, to Utah State University, originally as head of the Department of Music, and then lo and behold, this past year I've just been named dean, the founding dean of the Kane College of the Arts at Utah State.
And Kane is spelled C-A-I-N-E, named after a particular family, I suppose.
That is correct. The Kane family were original, also pioneers of Cache Valley and founders of Utah State University, originally a land-grant agricultural college that became Utah State University, and they were, and to this day, the Kane family are generous patrons of the arts, and in tribute to their incredible contribution through a century or more, this college has been named after them.
And let's say quickly that Dean Jessup will be conducting a festival chorus in Champaign-Urbana, where this radio program originates, Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, this next November. It'll be a chorus made up of, I suppose the main part of it will be the chorale that Julie Byler has formed 28 years ago. It's been singing here in this community, and but other singers are encouraged to join in with the chorale and learn from Dr. Jessup on this weekend of a choral festival weekend. That'll be November 5, 6, and 7, and there'll be a free concert that everyone is invited to at 7 p.m. on Sunday, November 7, at McKinley Presbyterian Church, 5th and John Street in Champaign. So this is advance notice for that free concert, but also for singers who'd like to join the chorale for that weekend. I had a wonderful personal experience in Utah and Idaho singing with Dean Jessup just about a month ago, and so I can certainly recommend this for other people who can read music well and want to sing.
Thank you, Steve. This is my third time to appear with the chorale and Julie Byler, and I must say she's given a magnificent service to your community. And each time, it's been a great opportunity for me. So I'm looking forward to returning.
But that raises a big question, Dean. How can you do all the Dean administration and travel around still conducting choirs?
Well, I have to limit the invitations that I receive. But part of my service with Utah State University is as a musical artist, a performing artist, and it's actually part of what the university would like me to do. So I have to limit them, but I look forward when those opportunities come to go out and make some music.
Let's talk about the difficulties, if there are any, of being a person of faith, in your case, a lifelong member of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons of the Mormon Church, in a state university, a land-grant university. What have you discovered already in your time there as head of the music department and now as dean in keeping those in some kind of a balance?
Well, I have I've found no problem whatsoever, either here or any other aspect of my career, either as a high school teacher in a state-run school system or working for the United States Air Force. I believe in the separation of church and state, and that this is the right of a free nation for anyone to freely worship and believe and express their beliefs as they choose, provided that it's within, you know, in the grounds and the ethics of the country where they're living. I have no problem at all. And I also honor and respect the values and beliefs of others, whatever their faith might be.
When you first took the position as director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir with its wonderful history and this long, over 80-year broadcasting tradition of the music and the spoken word program each week broadcast all over the world, there you could combine very publicly your own personal faith with the music you were performing. Was that a special treat?
It was a great time, a great experience. Music in the spoken word is the longest continuous network radio broadcast in the world. And it has to be, had to be, and continues to be, non-denominational.
Uh-huh.
It could not be a platform or a forum for for proselytizing or advocating any dogma of any faith. So, again, it was not a huge difference from any other position, even though the choir is sponsored by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The program Music in the Spoken Word was always a program of faith from a non-denominational point of view.
When did you grow up in a Mormon family?
I did. As I said, I'm fourth generation on both sides.
Uh-huh.
My father, English converts, and my mother's side, Scottish converts of the church. So it's pretty deep in my blood, and the same with my wife and her family as well.
Was the family you grew up in also very musical?
No, believe it or not, certainly they enjoyed music, but neither of my parents were musical or performed in any way. I'm told that my great-grandfather, the original pioneer that came to Utah from England, he and his brother Richard and Thomas were quite musical and formed a quartet once they arrived in the valley and sang around. But I'm sort of the black sheep of the family of my generation.
And we might say that Cache Valley, for those who may not be familiar with that beautiful part of Utah, is spelled C-A-C-H-E, like you cache something away. You perhaps bury it or save it for future use.
It's from the French fur trappers who would cache their furs there and hide them away.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Dean Craig Jessup, former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and now dean of the College of the Arts and professor of music at Utah State University in Logan, Utah, who will be directing here in Champaign-Urbana November 5, 6, and 7, a festival choir and giving a concert. Listeners are encouraged to join in this conversation. I'm happy to ask questions. I'm a curious guy, but we know our listeners also have comments and would like to ask questions, so do give us a ring. You can be on the air live with our guests if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. Punch in 333-9455 to your telephone, and our good engineer, Kyle Crowell, will answer the phone and put you in the queue, as the English say, to be on the air. If it's a long-distance call, perhaps you're listening online around the country, indeed around the world, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call if you're in the continental U.S. That's 1-800-222-9455, or in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, 333-9455. Dean Jessup, it was fun seeing you conduct. I had seen you, I guess, on television, of course, heard recordings of the Tabernacle Choir when you were its director, but to actually be in the room with you while you're telling people how to improve their sound and sing together, and there are several things you did that I thought were fascinating. One was how passionate you were just about the whole result. Why do you care so much?
Well, I guess that's a good question. I do care, and I do have a great love for choral music. I can't remember hardly a time in my life from the time I'm a very young boy that I was not involved in making choral music. And as a young teenager, there was no question this is what I wanted to do. I was very fortunate to discover early in life this was where I wanted to put my interest and my and work, and I was very blessed with incredible opportunities. So, yes, I do have a passion for it, and I love what it does for people. I think choral vocal music is has some of the most profound repertoire in all of music of Western civilization. And the magic that happens when a choir sings that's well-trained has a strong emotional impact on listeners. And I like what happens. I like what it does to people. I also think that it lifts people's hearts and spirits, and it's such a positive human enterprise to be involved in.
What was the first choir you sang in?
It would have been in my elementary school days. I remember my first grade teacher, Mrs. Floyd. She could play the piano, and at least once a week she would wheel in this little old piano in the Millville Elementary School in the first grade, and we'd sing, and I was in absolute heaven. I think you could call that my first choir. And also, I'd have to say, in church, from the very earliest toddler years, growing up in a Mormon community, in a Mormon church, music is an important part of the culture and the tradition, and those would have been the very first choirs that I sang in.
Can you remember what a early song that you learned in church might have been?
Oh, absolutely.
Give us a taste.
Well, in the primary, they're still singing some of these songs. For example, Jesus wants me for a sunbeam. Do you know that song, Steve?
Sure, let's do a duet.
Jesus wants me for a sunbeam to shine for him each day.
That's probably enough. But
how's that?
That's pretty good.
I remember as a boy, there were also some songs in, as primary children that would sing. One, a favorite, Mormon favorite, is Popcorn Popping on the Apricot Tree. Do you know that
one? No, not at all. Let's hear it.
I looked out the window and what did I see? Popcorn popping on the apricot tree. Spring had brought me such a nice surprise. Popcorn popping right before my eyes. You never forget these songs.
I love it. But now when we were doing that little impromptu duet, I couldn't help imagining that you were pointing your index finger to the sky, hoping that I'd see it and keep my voice going up rather than...
Exactly. The object of good choral singing is to always go sharp.
And tell our listeners why that's an interesting point, an important point.
Well, I just have, through the years, I have found maybe it's gravity. I don't know. But choirs tend to sing on the flat side of the pitch. And I tell them that the reason God gave them a brain is so they'd sing in tune. And so this raised left index finger of mine has become a permanent gesture, I'm afraid, to remind choirs to keep the pitch up on the high side. Don't let it sag.
And there's a tendency you taught us that if we're particularly staying on the same note, that note tends to sag, and the longer we stay on it.
That's correct. So if basses have, say, they're singing a G pitch, and they sing six G's in a row, the sixth G must be sharper than the first one because it's natural. The place it wants to go is about a quarter step flat.
Now, you were a baritone soloist with the Robert Shaw Chorale for, 7 years or so?
I sang in the Robert Shaw Festival Singers for 10 years.
10 years. And you traveled all over the world with them, of course.
Yes and no. There are really only two places we would spend. The Robert Shaw Festival Singers would come together every summer in southern France. And it was 60 singers, primarily from America. And we would prepare 2 to 3 programs, tour around marvelous old cathedrals in southern France. And then for about 4 weeks, at the end of the fourth week, we would record for Telarc 2 to 3 CDs. And then the following January, we would gather again in Carnegie Hall in New York City and become the core of the Carnegie Hall Robert Shaw Choral Workshop. So in southern France, some of the many recordings, the Rachmaninoff Vespers, which received a Grammy Award, it's just, to me, pure spirituality. A collection of the Robert Shaw, Alice Parker arrangements of American folk hymns and spirituals, a CD called Amazing Grace, a CD of the Brahms Liebeslieder Waltzes and the Neues Liebeslieder Waltzes, several others. It was an incredible time. And then at Carnegie Hall, major choral orchestral works like Elijah and the Verdi Requiem, the Seasons, the Creation of Haydn, the Benjamin Britten War Requiem. It was, I think, the 10 years that I sang with Robert Shaw as a singer in the chorus were probably the most intense and wonderful training period of my whole life in choral music.
Now, since 2005, you've been back in Carnegie Hall regularly with the National High School Choir Festival. Tell our listeners about that here in Illinois and Indiana that might want to know.
Carnegie Hall itself, Carnegie Hall is the site of many festivals, but generally they are festivals that are organized by outside agencies who rent Carnegie Hall and bring singers there to sing. But Carnegie Hall as an institution itself, sponsored under the Weill Institute of Music at Carnegie Hall, the National High School Honors Choir, and I, for 6 years, was the director of that. And I think largely they came to me because I had been there for the previous 10 years singing with Robert Shaw and had a real affection for the place and understood what its values and its commitment to choral and music education were. So we would audition choirs from around the nation. There would be close to 100 choirs that might apply by tape. Carnegie Hall staff would screen them, choose what they felt were the top 10, send then the tapes to me, and then I would select from the top 10 my top 4, and they would bring generally 4 to 5 choirs, no more than 200 voices, to Carnegie Hall. I would visit every choir during the school year, spend a day with them, then we would come together for 5 days in New York, and over the 6 years, we did the Mozart Requiem, the Durafle Requiem, the Vaughan Williams Dona Nobis Pacem, the Poulenc Gloria, the Stravinsky Symphony of Psalms, Michael Tippett, A Child of Our Time, with the Orchestra of St. Luke's and soloists from often the Metropolitan Opera. And it gave these high school students an opportunity, second to none, to do major choral orchestral works with professional musicians in Carnegie Hall. It was a fantastic experience.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Dean Craig Jessup from Utah State University, where he is Dean of the College of the Arts, Kane College of the Arts, in Logan, Utah. He's the former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. He'll be performing and conducting a festival choir here in Champaign-Urbana, November 5, 6, and 7 of this year, with a free concert at McKinley Presbyterian Church on November 7, Sunday night at 7 p.m. That's on the corner of 5th and John in Champaign. Singers who'd like to have the experience of singing with him may call Julie Byler, the director of the chorale that's sponsoring his appearance. Her phone number is 217-586-2970. That's 217-586-2970. Let me give the phone numbers for people who'd like to talk today with our guest. You may call 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. If it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455. And if you've missed part of this program or any other Keeping the Faith programs, as well as other locally produced ones here at WILL AM 580, you may, of course, access them online by going to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And if you can't remember all that, go to will.illinois.edu AM, when you get the options AM, FM, or TV. Go to AM, and then you can search for Craig Jessup in the search engine. Well, we're about halfway through the program, Craig. Let me let you have a chance to sip a glass of water or something, and I'll make a couple announcements. Next week here on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be David Boyer. We'll be talking to him from San Francisco by phone. He's the executive director of a new organization called Ways to Help that encourages high school students around the country to be involved as volunteers in community service. That'll be August 22nd here on Keeping the Faith, 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time. Coming up on future programs, Shirley Stillinger, social worker, will be talking with us about the homeless mentally ill. In September, also author Don Kurtz, author of Churchgoers, a fascinating novel about a university town and its liberal pastor and its a very conservative but charismatic pastor and some of the people in their congregations and families. We'll be talking with the author of that book, Don Kurtz, also in September. A quick announcement about the University Y's program, Dump and Run. The University Y has been gathering things, particularly back when students left the campus, that students often throw away but are still useful. The Y has stored these in big tractor trailers and over the summer, and they'll be unloading them the next day or two at the Stock Pavilion here at the University of Illinois. And there'll be a giant sale Saturday, August 21, from 8 in the morning till 4 at night, and Sunday from 11 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, of all these items, furniture and clothes and books and tapes and CDs, probably none of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir because people would never give them up. But there's all kinds of music and books and hundreds of other items. So, of course, students, international students get in free. There's a dollar or two charge for people to go that first day to get in. But there's so many bargains there, and students will often be able to outfit their whole apartments with things they buy there for very small prices. The money helps the University YMCA, and it also, of course, keeps all this stuff from being thrown away earlier in the year. Again, that's Saturday, August 21st from 8 to 4, Sunday from 11 to 4. The Pakistan Graduate Student Association at the University of Illinois has organized a dinner to raise money for Pakistani flood relief. You've all heard on the news, just on All Things Considered before this program, about the horrible effect of the floods in Pakistan. And on August 21st at 6 p.m., the Pakistan Graduate Student Association is having a dinner, $30 donation, please. And that'll be at the Research Park Gateway Building, 1800 South Oak Street in Champaign. If you'd like more information, call Osmoon at 819-9492. Again, you can get information or tickets, make reservations, calling 819-9492. If you'd like to make a contribution for Pakistani relief, you may make your check out to Islamic Relief and send it to the treasurer at 502 West Griggs Street, apartment 306, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. That's Treasurer, 502 West Griggs Street, apartment 306, Urbana, 61801. Make the check out to Islamic Relief. They're hoping to raise $50,000 to help with this project. Okay, let's get back to our guest, Craig Jessup. We do have a couple callers. Let's go first to line number one in Champaign. Yes, you're on the air with our guest.
Yes, hi, how are you? I just have a quick question. Is Jessup a well-known Mormon name, and are you in any way related to or connected with the man who was so infamous, who was talked about so much in the news and arrested for his polygamy? Thank you.
Jessup is... whether it's well-known in the Mormon faith, I couldn't say, but it certainly goes back to the early days of the church. And Willie Jessup is the man you're referring to. And I'm certain that if you go far enough back in our genealogy, we're probably related, but I don't know him, and I don't know exactly what the genealogy. The one thing about the reason I'm saying I'm certain we're related is it's J-E-S-S-O-P, and often there's a branch of the family that's J-E-S-S-U-P as well. So probably a distant relative, but that's not really all I know.
Since since sometimes people only know about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by hearing about the fundamentalist branch of that, which does...
Yeah.
Still claim plural marriage. You might say something about what the your branch of the main branch of Mormonism has believed and taught for decades.
Right. Back in about 1880s, 1890s, the Mormon Church issued which they called the Manifesto, which stopped the practice of polygamy in the Mormon faith. So it's been, you know, well over 100 years. But there were, in any religious movements, factions who refused to go with the main branch of the church and broke off. And this particular, I think they refer to themselves as fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, continue that practice this day. And often they're confused by the two. But the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has not practiced and disavowed polygamy back in the 1890s and has been firm in that position ever since.
We have another caller on line two from Decatur. Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm interested in finding out about the rehearsal times on the November 4th, 5th, 6th weekend.
5, 6, 7, yeah.
5, 6, 7, yeah.
I can give those.
Have those been announced yet?
I can give those to you. Friday night, 7 to 9:30, Saturday, 9 to noon, and 1 to 5. Dress rehearsal from 2 to 4:30 on Sunday, 6 p.m. call for a 7 o'clock concert. So it's a lot of singing, a lot of rehearsing, but from having done about 6 hours a day in Utah earlier in the summer, you won't be bored.
Sounds like a wonderful opportunity.
Well, I look forward to meeting you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Again, that's for singers, if, in case you turned in late in the program, who'd like to join Dean Jessup when he comes to Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois for a festival choir weekend. That'll be November 5, 6, and 7, Friday night practice, Saturday during the day, and Sunday, and then a concert, a free concert at McKinley Presbyterian Church at 7 p.m. Let's talk a little bit more about singing and what it has to do with faith. What do you say when people remind you, hey, this is a democracy? Why are you telling us what to do?
Well, very good. Very good question. But I can counter that with, you probably, Steve, know what I'm going to say. You've heard me say it. The secret of good choral music is printed on our U.S. coins in Latin, e pluribus unum. Out of many, become many becoming one. And that's the hallmark of a great choir, many voices becoming one organic whole, one in pitch, one in rhythm, one in dynamic, one in diction, one in phrasing. So I'm pretty passionate about this uniting and becoming one. And one of the things I love about choral music is the fact that you can take a group of fairly average singers, and provided they're willing to work, you can create really quite an extraordinary sound when people unite their voices.
And from your experience singing in choirs, you had a solo quality voice that you developed and worked to develop, but how do you get that voice, which is so distinctive and powerful, to blend with those around you who may not have had that advantage either genetically or in training?
Well, Robert Shaw, he would always say the best voices make the best choirs. And that group of 60 singers was, they were phenomenal solo singers. But a really fine singer that's in control of their voice knows how, through good technique, to sublimate. It's more of an ego thing than anything, to surrender the individuality of the solo voice into the collective good of the whole. Mr. Shaw used to say great choral sound is like a piece of fabric, and that if there's a loose thread that sticks out, it weakens the fabric, it doesn't make it stronger. And of course he was referring to the voice that would stick out and would emerge from the smooth surface of the fabric. So I know you can take really great, fine solo voices, and provided their egos are such that they're willing to surrender to the good of the whole, you can create a magnificent sound. And you can also take a group of fairly average, untrained voices who have a basic musical skill, and you can create quite a luxurious, beautiful sound as well.
We have another caller on line one, a caller from Champaign. Go ahead.
Line one?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I have two questions, please, and I'm sorry to take you off of your topic, but I'm very interested in the Latter-day Saints. Is the Latter-day Saints still trying to convert dead Jewish people into their faith? That's number one. And is heaven still divided into a strata where black people are not able to get to the top tier and become God of their own kingdom? Thank you.
Two easy questions. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, let me say I'm not an official representative of the church in any way. I've gone back into the, even as director of the Tabernacle Choir, it's not an ecclesiastical position. So I'm not a spokesman. Having said that, I know the church very well. I know its doctrines and its policies very, very well. I'll take the first one, actually, I'll take the second one. The belief in Mormon doctrine of 3 degrees of glory in the celestial worlds is open to everyone. It's, you know, the best scripture I could say would be, in my Father's house are many mansions. I go and prepare a place for you. And there are no restrictions. I think she's referring to the time that there was a time in the history of the church when blacks were not given the Mormon priesthood, but that has long since passed. And the full gamut of blessings for a member of the church are open to the entire world, to the whole human race. Remind me of her first question.
About conversion, particularly she mentioned converting dead Jewish people to be Mormons.
That's the Mormon are avid genealogists and have a passion in collecting genealogies, and part of that is the belief that certain ordinances that are done in the temple can be done for those of deceased persons, like baptisms and marriages, in behalf of those that have passed on. And I know that there was at one time a desire and was collecting all names of all faiths around the world, including some people who had perished in the Holocaust. But the church, I know, came out and said they would not do this, and because it was offensive to some people. So that, it's a rather obscure thing, but I know that that has not happened since that time. So
Craig,
again, I'm not an official spokesman for the church in any way.
You mentioned that, but isn't it also true that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does not have clergy anyway, right?
It's a lay clergy. No one is one is paid. It's all a volunteer.
All volunteer.
And all young men from the time they're 12 can be ordained to the priesthood. At various levels in the priesthood,
but not females. Is that accurate?
That's correct. The priesthood is given to the males in the church.
Uh-huh. And did you have a 2-year time as a missionary?
I served a mission to England, to Yorkshire and Lancashire, and had a marvelous time. I was 19.
Did it involve music?
No, it didn't involve music in any way.
Hmm.
It was a proselytizing mission. Most of my time was spent knocking on doors and meeting people, and I had a fantastic experience.
We have had Mormon missionaries who were active here at the University of Illinois on this show previously, and they were quite good representatives of the church.
Yeah. You know, I would suggest if people had questions of doctrine or practices, the best place would be go to a website called LDS.org, and all of those questions and issues, I think that they could get the official statement from the church itself.
You talked about people being volunteers, leadership in the church. Tell listeners about the apostles and current prophet.
The current prophet, president of the church, is Thomas Monson. He has been a general authority of the church for over, I would guess, 50 years. He's a marvelous man, one of the kindest, most gentle souls you would find anywhere, and a man who has given great service, great humanitarian service all around the world. And he came, all of the presidents of the church come from a body called the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. These are 12 men organized on the same principle as Jesus in the early church when he called 12 to serve as special witnesses of Christ. It's the same principle today. Now all of these men come from different walks of life, and all of them served the church in volunteer capacities for the majority of their life. And this special call comes as special witnesses of Christ, great men, and they dedicate the remainder of their lives in this ministry.
People who visit Salt Lake City and go to the tabernacle and see the model of the temple and go through that huge conference center, I forget what it's called exactly, you have to be very impressed with the generosity of people in the Church of Jesus Christ and the Latter-day Saints in terms of tithing and giving money to the church that can be used to create such things.
Yeah, it's been, from the very beginning, temple and temple worship have been a special part, an identifying mark of the church. And the very first temple was built in Kirtland, Ohio, and then in Nauvoo, Illinois. And the great temple in Salt Lake City is an incredible statement of faith. Brigham Young was the supervisor of the building of that temple. The tabernacle is a public building where anyone can go into. The temples, once they're dedicated, are set apart as special houses of worship for the Latter-day Saints. And these temples are marvelous statements of faith and belief. So anyone coming to Temple Square in Salt Lake City could go into the tabernacle or into the conference center, which is where the two places where the tabernacle choir performs. But the temples themselves are restricted after they're dedicated to members of the church.
Let's talk a little bit about your present position as a dean at Utah State University. You yourself have a degree from Brigham Young, a master's, and there's also the University of Utah. Tell us about those. What are the differences between those three universities?
Well, Utah State University and the University of Utah are both state secular institutions. Utah State is the only land-grant university in Utah. The University of Utah in Salt Lake City was the first state-run university. Brigham Young University, on the other hand, is owned, operated, and managed by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's the largest private university in the United States. It's an incredible institution, and it now has campuses in Hawaii and Idaho as well. There are three Brigham Young University campuses. The main campus is in Provo, Utah. And it's a marvelous institution by any standards.
Now, all three of those universities in Utah have choral departments. Why is Utah State University the best?
I think because we produce the finest voices in the West, in northern Utah. We've always had a long tradition. Having said that, I must say that my colleagues, Ron Staley at Brigham Young University, and Brady Allred at the University of Utah. These are all marvelous institutions with great choral traditions, and we're very fortunate to have them as our sister institutions.
We're down to our last eight minutes or so. We can still get in some phone calls. Let me give the phone numbers again. Anywhere the program is heard, including online, if it's in the continental U.S., punch in 1-800-222-9455. If it's a local call in the Champaign-Urbana listening area, 333-9455. And let me remind listeners, this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, and online at will.illinois.edu. We have a call from Indiana, Terre Haute, on our toll-free line, number 4. Go ahead, please. Line 4. Yes, are you there?
Yes, hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
I have a volume of, it's called Hill's Practical Reference Library of General Knowledge from the year 1903, and it states in there that Oliver Cowdery and I think James Whitmer and a man named Harris all subsequently declared their testimony to be false. But the farmer Harris, having already supplied all the money, went ahead to publish the book. Can your guest explain that for me?
Do you know any of that history?
You know, Steve, I think I'm not the one qualified to really speak for the church or the history of the church. Yes, he's talking about the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon.
Ah, okay.
David Whitmer, Martin Harris, and Oliver Cowdery. And I would suggest the best thing to do is for you to have an official representative of the church on your program and take and field some of these questions. They're much more, I'm really not a church scholar or church historian. I know of these men, and in my faith and my tradition, they never denied their testimonies in spite of the fact that they left the church. They all returned, were rebaptized into the church and came back, never denied their testimonies as witnesses to the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon. Just like any matter of faith, whether you're Christian or any denomination of Christianity, in many ways these are matters of faith of the individual believer. So I think you've got a lot of interest there in Latter-day Saints. You ought to bring in an official representative of the church.
A scholar.
Yeah, and handle some of these questions. They're much more equipped to do so than I.
Let's get to your specific area of expertise. What is a vertical vowel?
A vertical vowel is one that is vertical and not horizontal, one where the jaw is dropped and the soft palate is raised, and I call it English Gothic perpendicular.
And why does that matter? To give us, maybe our listeners can hear a difference in the sound. Give us one and then the other.
Well, let's say ah as opposed to ah.
Ah.
Ah tends to be spread and horizontal. An ah tends to be more vertical. Now, within those two extremes, there are many shades of vowel colors. And the object of a good choir is to unify those vowels.
So that everybody is making the same sound, regardless of what part of the country they came from or how they're feeling that day or whatever.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
What are some of the other principles of good choral singing? We have people listening from many different religious traditions in which music is important.
Well, I would say, again, unity is one of the guiding principles, that you want to strive for a unified vowel sound, unity of pitch, and rhythmic ensemble. And as you know, when you worked with me, I would often say if I had to choose between pitch and rhythm, I would choose rhythm. That music is an art form that takes place in time. And like any other art form, it exists as a time is clicking by, and every element of music can occur on that continuum of time. So it's critical that the ensemble be unified in where these events in music take place on that continuum of time. So I'm a strong advocate for rhythm, and singers are particularly notorious for not counting. Instrumentalists discipline themselves much more than singers do. So we do a lot of count singing, and I try to really stress rhythmic unity.
What in the world is count singing?
That's an invention of Robert Shaw to get singers so they are all unified in a rhythmic sense. So he would take something like, say, For Unto Us a Child is Born of Handel, where you have these melismas of 16th notes, and so you're accustomed to hearing, For Unto Us a Child is Born, and so on in the melisma. So he'd just say, let us assign every rhythmic value a number or a portion of a number. And often he'd say, let's do this in two groups of four. So we'd do 1, 2, T, 4, 1, 2, T, 4, 1, 2, T, 4, 1, 2, 1 and 2 and T and 4 and 1 and 2 and T and 4 and 1 and 2. So that every note had its moment and was unified rather than a big smear of sound. Once you have that firmly in their minds, you'd add a text to it.
And why do you say T instead of 3?
The TH, this was a Shahism again. He thought the TH would take up more time and would slow down, and so he just changed the TH to a T. Instead of 3, we would do T.
And what about the importance of words and of people understanding the words as a choir? I hear there's perhaps up to 300 people singing together. And yet a poet has written these words and it's been carefully set to music. How do you get the choir to enunciate in a way that those words are understood?
Well, again, it can all be quantified and identified on the continuum of time, so you know precisely where a final consonant goes. The difference between choral music and instrumental music is one thing, and that's a text. And instrumentalists don't have to worry where to put on a final S or a final T or a final D, but singers do. And doing those things precisely, making text intelligible for an audience, is one of, I think, the primary responsibilities of the choral conductor. You want to deliver the text. It's what makes the choral instrument different and separate from the orchestral instrument. So I, because I am a singer and I've spent a lot of time in that world, texts are very important to me. And it's no different from a solo singer to a choral singer. But a choral singer sometimes must exaggerate textual matters far beyond what a choral singer or a solo singer would do. The more singers you have in a choir, the more they have to focus on elements of diction.
We're down to our last 3 minutes. Could you give us tell us what some of the favorite hymns are for the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints today?
Well, the quintessential Latter-day Saint hymn would be Come, Come, Ye Saints, written in Iowa in 1846. The founding Mormon prophet Joseph Smith had been murdered by a mob in Carthage, Illinois, thinking that the church would fall apart. But to the contrary, it thrived, and Brigham Young led the Latter-day Saints from Illinois across the plains to the Rocky Mountains, one of the great religious migrations of all time. And William Clayton, an English convert, while sitting in the plains of Iowa in a muddy rainstorm in his covered wagon, wrote this great Mormon hymn, Come, Come, Ye Saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you your journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive, our useless cares from us to drive, and soon we'll have this tale to tell. All is well, all is well. Four beautiful verses, and this hymn has found itself in Protestant hymnals now all over the nation. It's a great and probably the most famous of the Latter-day Saint hymns.
And I noticed that on YouTube there are perhaps some stolen examples of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing some of these great hymns that are quite popular.
Yeah. The current director of the Tabernacle Choir and my dear friend and colleague, Mac Wilberg, has made some extraordinary arrangements of these hymns, many of which I've recorded and Mac has recorded as well. And I think probably the hymns, when it's all said and done, hymns sung by the Tabernacle Choir through the years have been one of the hallmarks of the choir and one of the most requested and beloved portions of the repertoire of the choir.
You're now training future choral directors and singers as a professor of music and dean of the Kane College of the Arts at Utah State University. What do you hope for them?
Well, I hope that they might have as incredibly joyful and rich a life as I have enjoyed because of the art of choral singing. And I feel that in some ways it holds the key to a safer, better world, in that bringing many people from many walks of life, many faiths, and many backgrounds together and uniting in this common cause is a great metaphor in solving a lot of the ills of today. I think a choral situation holds in many ways the secret of bringing society together. And secret, it's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. The oldest probably art form known to man is singing. And usually associated originally in religion and in the praise of God. I can't think of a better enterprise to be involved in.
And that's where we're going to have to close tonight. That's a perfect summary of our program with Dr. Craig Jessup, Dean of the Kane College of the Arts at Utah State University and Professor of Music, former Director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Thank you very much, Dr. Jessup.
Thank you, Steve, and thanks to your listeners.
And again, Dr. Jessup will be leading a choral festival November 5, 6, and 7 in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. Singers are encouraged to give Julie Byler a call at 586-2970 to find out more about how they could join that. That'll be rehearsing on Friday night the 5th and Saturday the 6th with a free concert on Sunday evening the 7th p.m. at McKinley Presbyterian Church. Again, a reminder that the University Y is having its big dump and run sale Saturday, August 21 from 8 to 4 p.m. and Sunday from 11 to 4. All kinds of items for the home, and particularly students, international students particularly, are encouraged to go to that sale. It'll be at the Stock Pavilion at the University of Illinois on Pennsylvania Avenue, just west of just east of Memorial Stadium. And that's Saturday, August 21, and Sunday, the 22nd. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Thank you for listening.